Hi, my name is Seth Ariel Green, and I'm glad to be here on The Vegan Report. I'm a researcher at the Humane and Sustainable Food Lab at Stanford University. We're a research group at the medical school there aimed at accelerating society's transition away from factory farming. Today, we're looking at what gets people to cut back on consumption of meat and animal products, specifically persuasion, choice architecture, psychological appeals, and adding new plant-based meat analogs to menus. I'll be discussing two papers that I'm a co-author on. The first is called Meaningfully Reducing Consumption of Meat and Animal Products is an Unsolved Problem, a Meta-Analysis. The second is a preprint called Taking a Bite Out of Meat or Just Giving Fresh Veggies the Boot? Plant-based meats did not reduce meat purchasing in a randomized controlled menu intervention. If you're interested in this work, you can check out the lab I work at foodlabstanford.com. That's foodlabstanford.com. We have all of our publications there, including the two papers that I'm about to discuss. And I also write a Substack called Regression to the Meat. That's regression to the M-E-A-T. The lab is run by Maya Mather, who is a professor at Stanford. And I am a research scientist there. You can also find new episodes every Wednesday on this podcast. Okay, so we're going to go as follows. The meta-analysis, the first paper, is the main paper I'm going to be talking about. But because meta-analysis is a whole complicated thing, I'm going to describe the method in general and like why one would do this kind of paper. And then we're going to look at the paper itself. Next, I'll turn to the second paper. I'll start with its setup, and I'll then move to its results. And finally, we'll conclude with general lessons from the two. So that's five things I hope to cover. Maybe six. Okay, so let's start out with why meta-analysis, or rather, what is the whole point of this thing? Basically, a meta-analysis is a paper where you take the results of other papers and you amalgamate them into a conclusion about a literature as a whole. So let's say, like in the idealized case, you have 10 papers that all look at one thing. Let's say it's the effects of insecticide-treated malaria nets on infant mortality. If you have those 10 papers, meta-analysis is pretty easy. Basically, what you do is you put them all together, you look at the outcomes, and then you come up with a weighted average of those outcomes, where more weight goes to more precise estimates. And in practice, what this means is that bigger papers, those with more subjects, get more weight in the resulting average. Okay, so that's the idealized case. Like, the intervention is one thing, and the outcome is one well-defined thing, and you just give a weighted average of all the 10 interventions on the one thing and see, like, what the overall effect is. And the idea here is that if you look at 10 studies from 10 different locations, you're going to have a better sense of what the so-called true underlying population effect is than you would if you just chose one study. I think this is pretty intuitive. It's the same way that, like, if you want to figure out what Americans think about politics, you do a random sample of 100 people, not just 10 people, or not just one person. Like, you want just more samples, or a larger sample, rather. Okay, that's like the best case scenario. My lab, and, well, my work more generally, we're in the behavioral sciences, and meta-analysis can be a little trickier than that. The first is that, like, let's say you wanted to ask a question. This is the question that my paper actually asks. What gets people to eat less meat and animal products? Okay, so it's pretty clear what the outcome is. We're going to look at reductions in meat and animal products, which I'm henceforth just going to call MAP. So MAP is meat and animal products. But like, it's not at all clear that the research field as a whole agrees on what the right way to approach that is. So you could theoretically write this paper and look at like thousands of different approaches. And in that case, it's not totally clear what any weighted average you come up with actually means. So like, let's say we're looking at two papers, we want to meta-analyze them, and
One is a choice architecture intervention. That's the kind of thing where you manipulate something about an environment where someone eats meat and then see how that affects how much meat someone eats, right? So that could be a good example is like making the spoons with which people at cafeterias serve meat literally smaller, or like putting the plant-based option at eye level to try to guide people unconsciously towards that. Okay, so you have one study that's like that, and the other study is you make people watch Dominion, which is this really upsetting documentary of how animals are treated on factory farms. Okay, and then you average those two things together, and you get a number. But like, what does that number mean? What is the average of changing the spoon size and watching Dominion? Like, in some sense, it could be said to represent, you know, like the literature's best efforts. Like, if you said, this is what like our field is doing, this is how we're doing, this is our number. But in another sense, like, that average doesn't really correspond to anything you can point to in the real world, because these two things are just not alike. You like cannot average like the appleness of an apple and an orange. And then the other side of this problem is that the same thing is true of outcomes. So like, if one study reports food frequency questionnaires, which are just, you're supposed to tell a researcher what you ate over the past 24 hours, and the other is watching what people do and don't eat at a dining hall, it's also not clear what the average of these two outcomes actually signifies. Okay, so this is why meta-analysis is sometimes taken as like the definitive answer on what is the effect of X on Y. But when you read these papers, the hard question to ask is like, are these inputs even similar enough that we think they can be averaged, like conceptually? And likewise, are these outcomes all pointing at the same target? And if the answer to those questions is I'm not sure or I don't know, then you can come up with an answer to your question, but it's just not clear that it means anything. Okay, so that's why meta-analysis is hard. Nevertheless, I did one with my co-authors Benny Smith and Maya Mather on the question of what gets people to eat less meat and animal products, MAP, or which class of interventions is most effective. The way that we handle this problem of, wow, studies are so crazily diverse and we can't really make sense of everything, is like so. First, we only looked at studies that met a pretty high bar for research validity. And that meant a few different things. First, they actually had to measure consumption, not behavioral intentions or not attitudes. Pausing here to say, they can also measure behavioral intentions and attitudes, but they had to measure consumption behavior. And we only looked at that outcome. So at least we're comparing like to like, basically, for the results we're looking at within papers. And the second criteria was that they needed to have enough people in their samples that we thought that we could say something meaningful. So that was at least 25 people in treatment and 25 in control. And okay, I'm going to caveat here, it's something complicated. Not every intervention is assigned at the level of individual. Some things are like, on some days, cafeterias do something, and then not on other days. And it's not totally clear how many people came in and out. So for those kinds of studies where treatment was administered at the level of day or place, we said at least 5 units in treatment and control. And typically in all of those cases, there were like hundreds of people actually coming through. Okay. Third criteria, it had to be a randomized control trial, not any other kinds of design. This is just like for getting causal estimates. That is like X caused Y, RCTs, Trump, other designs. And fourth, they had to measure outcomes at least a single day after treatment was first administered. And the idea here was, you might have an intervention that really, really effectively reduces meat for like one meal. I mean, theoretically, you might just like not serve. You might make it like really hard or difficult to get meat. Like, what if you went into a restaurant and if you ordered a burger, they gave you an electric shock, and you would be like, "Oh my God, why'd you do that?" But that would definitely have an effect. But then, like, what happens when you go home? You probably hate the people who did this to you and eat like twice as many burgers. So we only look at studies that measure a delayed effect of some sort to try to get at, like, how do people deal with the intervention in their lives? Like, how do they compensate later? Okay, so that's the setup. And when we did that, we did this like long, thorough literature review, and we came up with about 35 papers met all our criteria, and that was 41 interventions and 112 interventions. So this literature, when we first started looking at it, it's like thousands or maybe tens of thousands of papers. I mean, broadly speaking, not all of them look strictly at like reductions in meat and animal products, but some of them might look at like, you know, trying to get kids to drink like oat milk or even like, you know, just cut back on fatty foods in general. There's a lot of different things here, but it started out as a huge literature, ended up with 35 papers. Most of those papers have been published since 2020, so this is a pretty modern literature. Okay, so 35 papers that meet all our criteria, which again are about quality, and they actually have to be trying to get people to eat less meat and or animal products. And those papers fell into four categories. Those were persuasion, choice architecture, psychology, and then these kind of combo persuasion and psychology papers. Going through each in turn. Persuasion is what it sounds like, is trying to get people to eat less meat by talking to them about it, or otherwise using like information to consciously persuade them. Persuasion efforts can come in three broad categories, broadly speaking, and those are, I bet you can see this coming, health, the environment, and animal welfare. So an environmental intervention, a good example is, it's a paper by Andrew Jalil and others from 2023 that replaced an intro economics course with just one lecture of it, with a lecture about the global warming consequences of meat. It also covered a little bit about the health into stuff. The health version of this is aimed at mostly talking about red and processed meat and how that's not good for you. But there are some health interventions that just broadly make the point that like you should be eating more vegetables. So we looked at those. And then the last one, the animal welfare stuff, this is like pamphlets and videos and op-eds. A lot of these studies, the animal welfare stuff, was run by animal welfare organizations. Okay, those are the persuasion approaches. Then there's the choice architecture, which is I've talked a little bit about earlier, but to rehash, that's changing the aspects of the context in which food is selected and consumed. So a good example, Anderson and Nalander, 2021, they, as I said earlier, just put the vegetarian option at a university cafe for the day at eye level or not. So that just changes how you see it or not. And then psychology studies are a really interesting broad category here. Basically, they want to manipulate how you think and feel about meat without necessarily giving you like direct reasons that you should eat it. So it's not like meat is bad for you, so you should eat less meat. It's more like, oh, did you know that plant-based options are increasingly popular and cool among your peers? That last example that's like increasingly popular and cool, this is the norms approach. And most psychology studies we looked at were norms-based interventions. And those basically try to make plant-based options seem like either normal or desirable. Those are two different kinds of norms interventions. And further, you might say that plant-based options are normal today, or you might do this other thing called dynamic norms where you say plant-based options are increasing in popularity. And the idea is there that people will do this pre-conformity thing where they like want to go to where people are going in the future. And finally, we have a couple papers that combine persuasion and psychological messages. One example is from Piester et al., P-I-E-S-T-E-R, 2020, and they put up messages around a dining hall, which I'm pretty sure was UVA, but it's like some school in, you know, South Central America, or the central region of the South in America. And they say, veggie burgers are a tasty, healthy choice. They have they're good for the environment. They're sustainable. Also, 95% of your peers agree that veggie burgers are the tasty choice. So that's doing some things to try to tell you why you should eat them, and it's doing some things that are trying to tell you how you should like think about or feel about the broader question of eating plant-based options. Okay. So those are our big approaches. We've got persuasion, choice architecture, psychology, and a combo of persuasion and psychology. What are our results? Doing a little drum roll here. Overall, we find nothing very impressive. In meta-analysis, it's common to standardize everything by turning it into hundredths of a standard deviation. So it's called Cohen's D, and a D of 1 is 1 standard deviation of change. A way to think about this is, like, if I did an intervention on children's SAT scores and I achieved a Cohen's D of 1, that would be equivalent to 100 points each on the verbal and math increase, because the standard deviation of the SAT is 100 points per section. In this context, it's a little less clear what a standard deviation means, but like, just go with it. It means like a D of 1 is like, oh, you really got the job done. Our overall Cohen's D is 0.07. That means 7/100ths of a standard deviation. In general, this corresponds to like a few percentage points change, or up to like 5 percentage points in some cases, or maybe like a, you know, notable reduction that levels out over time. Basically, we put everything together and we do not come up with the kind of transformational changes that we were looking for. That's why the paper is titled "Meaningfully Reducing Meat Consumption is an Unsolved Problem." Now, let me harken back to the problem I was saying earlier about how it's not totally clear that when you put all these studies together that it means anything, because I don't know what the average of a psychology study and a choice architecture study actually indicates. To deal with that, we then separated each approach into its own theoretical category, and we looked at those numbers by themselves. Basically, here's what we found. Choice architecture studies have the largest effect on average, about 0.2, which is, again, about a fifth of a standard deviation of change. And that's, you know, in some contexts, that could be meaningful. But we only had 2 studies that met that, meaning that almost every choice architecture study, like hundreds of them, did not qualify. Typically, that's because a lot of these choice architecture things either manipulate hypothetical environments. It'll like take you through an online grocery store and then like, you know, make the plant-based option more prominent, but you don't actually eat anything or choose anything. And the other reason is that everything is very immediate. So a good example is in the defaults literature, the paradigmatic defaults intervention would be, let's say you were hosting an academic conference and you were asked in advance what kind of meal you wanted, and your choices were vegetarian and non-vegetarian. In the default intervention version, your choice would just say, you will be getting a vegetarian meal. Please email us if you don't want that. That's great. It seems to have worked very well. My co-author Maya has a couple of really strong papers in this category. But we don't know what people do when they go home or when they like leave the conference. So yes, there's like some evidence that just making it a little annoying to get meat, like you have to write someone an email to say, yeah, I want the beef, reduces the amount of meat people order. But whether that has any lasting effect on people's behavior, I don't know. Okay, so that's choice architecture. I would say psychology is the second most, or psychological interventions, They have like about a tenth of a standard deviation of change. This dynamic norm stuff, if you want to read more about it, there's lots of cool papers on if you search like dynamic norms at MEET, you'll probably encounter papers by Greg Sparkman, who's a professor at BC. I would say his lab is like the main center of this kind of research. It's really hard to use these interventions to get people to do things. Or you can get them to change a little bit, but it's like it works at a classic paper with Greg and co-authors finds good changes in one setting, no changes in another, and like a backlash in a third. And when you look at these all together, it's really unclear why it worked in one place and not in another. We don't know. Like one explanation is that maybe there's something going on that we don't know about why it works in better in some contexts and others, not others. But the other possibility is that it's just really noisy, meaning like the true answer is zero or pretty close to zero, but there's spread around that just because of random variation. So it's going to look sometimes like you get a positive result, but it's just noise. Okay, but I don't really know. That's sort of an ongoing area of research. In general, persuasion efforts, we get a D of 0.07, which is the same as our overall, and that masks a little bit of heterogeneity. In general, animal welfare appeals don't seem to be working. We get a D of 0.03 for all animal welfare appeals. That's not enough to like do anything with. It's 0.09 for the environment and 0.08 for health. These are, again, all I'm just saying about these is that they're really small numbers. Like, I think for animal welfare, like, not even a percentage point change on average. And for health and environment, maybe, like, a couple percentage points changes on average. And persuasion and psychology combos are, like, a D of 0.11, which is about as effective as psychology on its own. Okay, so what do we make of this? I still don't know how to digest these results. I wrote this stupid paper, this great paper. Like, do we just stop? I mean, that's very discouraging, but I would say that it's discouraging to me that if you look at, like, there have been some previous meta-analyses that found big results, and what we think basically happened, or I'm just going to say me, what I think happened, is that those papers hoovered in studies with much weaker designs and measurement strategies, and weaker designs are just more likely to produce stronger effects for complicated reasons. This is what the online writer Gwern, G-W-E-R-N, calls the stainless steel law of evaluation, which is that the better designed the impact assessment of a social program, the more likely is the resulting estimate of net impact to be zero. So we only look at like what I consider pretty good studies, and we found basically no effect. So in some ways that's discouraging. On the other hand, I would say this literature is getting better and better, like in terms of its methodological quality. As I said, most of the papers we looked at are from pretty recently. That's great. We still think there's a lot of untapped ground. And also, there's a lot of theoretical stuff that can be done that isn't in our data set. So, for instance, what about like extended contact with farm animals? Does that change anything? Manipulations to the price of meat itself, like a little stimulated small-scale meat taxes. None of those studies have been tested in a way that meets our criteria. There was a dearth of disgust studies, like, ew, oh my god, how much, I had no idea that so much milk and blood and pus was allowed in milk. Almost nothing that evaluated that was like done rigorously. I think there's some pretty good potential for fiction to be rigorously evaluated, like go ahead and show a lot of people like Lisa the Vegetarian, which is a Simpsons episode, or Babe, which made its farmer, the guy who played the farmer, James Cromwell, he went vegan after being in that movie. Or Okja, which is like explicitly an animal rights parable. So I still think there's a lot of room here to go. Now, the next thing is that some people might say, what about like fake meat options? Isn't that the thing? Doesn't everybody love like Beyond Meat or Impossible Meat? You haven't talked about that. Why not? Which gets us to our next paper, which again is called Taking a Bite Out of Meat, or just giving fresh veggies the boot. Plant-based meals did not reduce meat purchasing in a randomized controlled menu intervention. Now, that title basically tells you what the whole paper is about, but I'll give you the setup. So it's an online survey. We get people into the survey and we give them questions about like choosing pens, choosing t-shirts. It's like a, you know, we tell them it's a consumer choice survey. And then one of those things is they choose a taco filling in a from a menu that looks a lot like Chipotle's. And they were randomized into three treatments. The first is the only plant-based option is veggies and guac. And you got a bunch of meat options like beef barbacosa or barbacoa, I think, and like carnitas and chicken, and maybe and steak, I think. Okay, that's the first treatment arm. The second is you got the veggies and guac, but you also have sofritas, which is this thing that Chipotle has. It's like a, you know, pork analog, tofu-based thing. If you've been to Chipotle, I think it's pretty good. And then the third option is this hypothetical thing we invented and showed people called chickenitas, which is like a fake chicken plant-based analog. And the idea is, does seeing more plant-based options or does having more plant-based options available make you more likely to select plant-based? The answer is kinda, like a little, but not much and not enough to be statistically significant. Adding sofritas reduced demand for meat by 1.14 percentage points relative to having just chips and guac, or veggies and guac. And adding sofritas and chickenitas together reduced demand for meat by 2.14 percentage points. So, you know, 2 percentage points is something. If we could, like, do that at all the Chipotle stores in America, that would probably be a big something. But we were aiming for 5 percentage points change, which we think is basically, like, the smallest amount we could feasibly tell Chipotle, hey, look, there's unmet demand for plant-based options, so you should add another one. We also noted that as we added more and more veggie options, the demand for the veggies and guac options decreased. So it started out in the no plant-based meat analogs options. It was 9.2%. And then in the arm with sofritas, it goes to 6.6%. And the arm with sofritas and chickenitas, it goes to 5.7%. So one unfortunate conclusion to this is that when you add a new plant-based meat option, meat analog option to your menu, at least some of that demand is coming from vegetarians or people who would otherwise be eating vegetarian. The paper has some other results that, you know, are kind of like just confirming that this is basically legit. For instance, men eat more meat than women. Republicans eat more meat than Democrats. People without a four-year college degree eat more meat than people who do or choose more meat in this context. So when I put all these results together, it sure might sound like I'm a huge hater. Like I'm saying, oh, nothing works, sorry, go home. Sometimes I do feel that way. This is a really tough problem we're working on. I think that's overall the conclusion that I would give from these papers, is that it's really hard to get people to eat less meat and animal products. Anyone who has told you otherwise, my honest-to-God opinion is that they probably weren't evaluating the intervention very rigorously. And I don't, that's like nothing special about our field. This is just true about social science research. Again, the better designed an evaluation, the more likely the resulting estimate of net impact is to be zero. On the other hand, I still think there are lots of cool things that should be tried and can be tested rigorously. And what I'm personally interested in at the moment is something closer to like mental categorization. So like, how do vegetarians think about the question of eating meat versus eating eggs? Things like that. And lastly, I would say, if and when plant-based meat is as good as or even cheaper than meat, that's going to be a game changer. But I just wish to caveat that by saying that there does not seem to be any evidence of that happening anytime soon. So, again, sorry to be the bearer of bad news. What I'm saying is basically that this is a hard problem, and we just need to keep cracking at it. Thanks for listening to my bucket of cold water of a podcast recording. If you have any questions, you can find me at SethArielGreen.com. Green, like the color. You can find our lab at foodlabstanford.com. You can find my newsletter at regressiontothemeat, meat.substack.com. Thanks very much for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you if you have any questions. Thanks.